ora, and welcome back to System Fix, the podcast for health reform junkies from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, I speak to regular panellists and invited guests about change in the New Zealand health sector, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to System Fix in 2024. 2003 is quickly becoming a distant memory as the Great Kiwi Summer does an excellent job of wiping the neural slate clean. So I'm taking the opportunity of a short, unexpected convalescence on my part to refresh my own memory and look over my writings in the last year. The heart of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa lies in primary care, and you'll hear that theme loud and strong in my editorials. I'm not promising a comprehensive look at the year, more of a flyby. You could always fast forward when 2023 gets too much. Listen out for the musical quotes direct from the articles. But for now, settle in and drift back to early 2023 when Jacinda Ardern was Prime Minister, Andrew Little was Health Minister, and Rob Campbell was Chair of Te Whatu Ora. Mr. Little could talk up primary care no trouble, but he didn't really understand the sector's low self-esteem and how the simple ongoing broken promise of funding reform ate at its heart. And by words easily translated across languages and acted upon, words that cut through political cant. In the health sector, the term wayfinder was no doubt the subject of much eye-rolling, where some say wayfinder, others hear wayfarer, and others became waylaid and left by the wayside. Within it was an admission, just maybe, that a way still needed to be found to move the health reforms forward. I often refer to the health reforms as the Big Little Revolution, because Andrew Little took the reforms several steps further than had been recommended in the original Simpson report. When the Pai Ora legislation was passed, it gave Te Aka Whai Ora, the Māori Health Authority, a bigger role than originally recommended, and it introduced iwi Māori partnership boards as Te Tiriti partners. Mr. Little expressed a determination to proactively seek equity in health outcomes for Māori, but the promises made of primary care funding reform are yet to eventuate, and this has affected Māori providers as much as the rest of the primary care sector. Ms. Ardern's resignation saw a cabinet reshuffle. New Prime Minister Chris Hipkins had experience of the health sector with a short stint as health minister, following the fall from grace of David Clarke in 2020, and Hipkins had also been the COVID response minister. Associate Health Minister and Infectious Diseases Physician Aisha Viral became health minister. Harking from secondary care, there was no guarantee Viral would get primary care, though she had seen it at work in the COVID response. As with previous doctor health ministers, she would no doubt deal with vested interest murmurings from around the cabinet table when it came to budget time. Our team was yellow stickered out of our office after the Auckland anniversary weekend flooding, and then along came Cyclone Gabrielle. We mostly escaped significant physical damage, but mentally, like everyone else, we are reeling at the images of the damage done to the homes and livelihoods of so many people and the heartbreaking loss of life. We never returned to our offices on Auckland's North Shore. The following weeks were reminiscent of the early days of COVID, back to working from home while we hunted for new premises. Temporary? We didn't know. Our reporters kept up a steady flow of news. Beneath the trail of destruction wrought by atmospheric rivers across the country, alarm bells were sounding about the prospects of new money for health in the budget, given the money now required for the emergency response. And more immediate, measles was back on the horizon with outbreaks in Africa, India and Indonesia, and an imported case was detected locally. Attention turned to the new public health regime, a many-headed beast. There was a new public health agency sitting inside the Ministry of Health, described as the lead for all public health and population health strategy, policy, regulatory intelligence, surveillance and monitoring. But that agency does not commission or provide services. That is the territory of the new National Public Health Service sitting inside Te Whatu Ora. It is mostly made up of the former regional public health agencies. The third new element, the Public Health Advisory Committee, has a mission to provide independent advice to the other two agencies and to the Health Minister. It feels like quite a crowded space, this new regime. The key will be knowing who's responsible for what and who's making the decisions on priorities and spending, and knowing where the buck stops when the next public health crisis hits. Mr. Campbell soon saw the size of the problem and the long-cursed shadow cast by inequity upon the health outcomes for Māori. He became a passionate advocate for change to address that. Then he was sacked for breaching the code of conduct for Crown Entity board members, for getting too passionate about equity matters, and criticising the National Party's water services policy as dog whistle politics. Remember that Big Little Revolution I mentioned earlier? Well, the man former Health Minister Little appointed to drive that revolution was Rob Campbell, whose pedigree included trade unionism and corporate boardrooms. The leader of the revolution was sacked for being too revolutionary. With him went 12 months of relationship building, most importantly with iwi and Māori providers. In a sector that stands and falls on relationships, it was a big blow. I understand the need for a code of conduct to ensure political neutrality of public servants, but the rhetoric around Campbell's sacking was such that you could be forgiven for thinking he and his board colleagues were members of a silent monastic order. Throughout the process of health sector reform, several talking points were repeatedly reiterated. The need for a culture change, the need for whole sector thinking, and the need to address equity. Te Whatu Ora was not to be a super DHB, it was to be something better. It must have been extremely galling for Campbell that, having become attuned to inequities in health, and knowing health services alone contribute only 20% of what constitutes good health, he was required to stay silent in his corner. But inequity cannot be unseen, and once seen, silence is not an option. In an exit interview with New Zealand doctor reporter Martin Johnson, Campbell confirmed what the primary care sector already knew. The reforms were shortchanging primary care and communities. Despite the reforms arising from a 2017 election promise of a primary care funding review, primary care and their new platform, localities, sit in the long tail of the reforms. It was feeling increasingly likely there would be an insufficient revolutionary fuel in the tank to move the necessary millions of dollars and other resources to the front line of primary and community care. How do you excite people about another workforce yarn, providing another chapter in a long story of neglect? You have to, because for a government that claims it wants a health service that is patient-focused and primary care-driven, this is the biggest story in town. In 5 years, 1,212 GPs out of 3,488 surveyed in the latest College of GPs workforce survey say they intend to retire. 1,212 GPs gone from the workforce. The workforce tipping point has been forecast for years and pretty much ignored by anyone with the power to affect change. Plenty of energy has gone into finding ways to bolster the primary care workforce, with practice nurses top of scope, the development of the nurse practitioner workforce, clinical tasks shifted to pharmacists, extended care paramedics coming on the scene, and now eyes turned to physician assistants or associates. All the time, telehealth hovers as some sort of ethereal saviour. It's often done a bit half-assed. Practice nurses pushed to work top of scope but not funded to do so. Law changes forget to mention nurse practitioners in the same breath as GPs. Work shifts but funding doesn't. Clinical responsibility falls out of step with registration status. And time and again, the folks in charge forget to check with the workforce they seek to supplant, supplement, subdue. The slicing and dicing of the primary care workforce to cover the lack of attention to the general practice workforce ignores a basic fact. If we want people treated in the community and outside of expensive secondary care facilities, we need medical expertise in the community. How about a specialist who is a generalist who can do a differential diagnosis that will see a patient treated in the right place at the right time? Let's call them a specialist general practitioner. If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. Hospitals are dangerous places if you don't need to be there. Besides which, not everybody has access to one. As Samantha Merton, College of GPs president, sees it, quote, "I am all for a broader primary care team, but the focus on health professionals who are quicker to train while delaying an increase in general practitioners suggests a belief that medical expertise is replaceable. Personally, I cannot see the economics or patient benefits to having a multitude of people involved in someone's care while losing the expertise of those able to manage a multitude of conditions. End of quote. Meanwhile, Campbell did not go quietly into the night as the government might have hoped. He took to sharing his concerns about the reforms in a number of speeches throughout the year. And he spells out what primary care folk have known for years, that they are treated as a problem to manage, with little effort made to engage with them or involve them in the process of change. He points to the failure to deal with primary care funding and nurse pay parity. On that note, a short explainer. Nurse pay parity in primary care has been a long-standing issue. Essentially, every time public sector nurses, mostly working in hospitals, get a pay rise funded by the taxpayer, the primary care sector, mostly funded by private business and NGOs, faces pressure to increase the pay of its nurses, but without the benefit of an increase in government funding. Nurses leave the primary care sector for secondary care, and the resourcing problems in primary care inevitably see patients land in secondary care. It feels a bit like that image of a snake eating its tail. Veteran medical politician and former college president Tim Molloy had no answer as to why, after all the workforce reports, the evidence on pay parity, and the research showing the benefit of primary care-led health systems, nothing had really changed. But he did warn, quote, if they ask you for another report, you have already lost, end of quote. Unable to unravel the puzzle of politicians ignoring evidence, I went off distractedly and googled 1,212, that number of exiting GPs. I got 5 million results and discovered 1,212 is an angel number. Apparently such a number can indicate the universe warning you to act with caution when you are thinking about pursuing a number of ideas you have in mind. You need to make a choice. It's April by now, and there is more workforce turmoil on the horizon as Te Whatu Ora starts to lay out its new structure, and around 1,600 people face changes in their work life, ranging from redundancy to a change in job title. The process turns into a bit of a shambles with lengthy documents and poorly executed processes, leaving many in the system unclear whether they're in the firing line or not. By July, over 300 full-time jobs have gone. I spent an uplifting, albeit short, break in the South Island High Country, a region born of uplift as the Pacific and Indian tectonic plates meet and greet. On my return, I found more uplift in action. I had noticed the occasional official use of the word uplift with regard to funding and wrote a short online post asking why a perfectly good word had been ambushed by health officials to be used in a context where it makes no real sense. Come May, and while awaiting the budget, I'm perplexed by all the uplifting going on and funding, not landforms. For some reason, I've been ignorant of this financial use of the word uplift. A funding uplift sounds to me a bit like a bank robbery. Nevertheless, talk of uplifts was everywhere as the budget approached. Yes, it turns out funding can be uplifted, if not always uplifting, but I still prefer the association of uplift with excitement, elation, and perkiness. Funding uplift suggests generosity, which is not always present. I'm left pondering if there is an opposite to uplift. Might it be downfall? And the budget? The centrepiece for health is $157 million to scrap the $5 prescription charge. Along with that comes $99 million for winter 2023 initiatives, $118 million to reduce waiting lists by freeing up inpatient hospital beds, and $20 million to improve health equity for Māori and Pacifica. Locality, locality, locality. It is primary care real estate, in essence, and it is fast acquiring the tropes essential to a gripping episode of Build It and Weep, TV show Grand Designs. We've got workforce shortages, project management problems, and the ubiquitous Baroque dreams on a minimalist budget, all pulled together with a passion that refuses to see boundaries. Localities are, were, maybe, the promised land for primary care, though not necessarily for primary health organisations. However, not only the route but destination has become murky. At this point, let's pull over and take another look at the map, the first map. It is worth remembering back when the final Health and Disability Review Panel report came out, that's the Simpson report, the health sector landscape was envisaged differently than the reforms delivered. There was a Ministry of Health and a new Māori Health Authority. Sitting alongside the Ministry was a new Health New Zealand, quite separate from the remaining 8 to 12 DHBs. And the new environment for primary care was localities, which were to engage with those new DHBs. As the Simpson report stated, Health New Zealand would not just be there to tell DHBs what to do. It would be an organisation responsible for working with all parts of the delivery system to ensure it operated effectively, fairly and sustainably. But that structure didn't happen, and in choosing instead to merge all DHBs into one and make the resulting entity the main chunk of Health New Zealand Te Whatu Ora, I think the lie of the land changed for localities. Instead of having a relationship with DHBs, they were now in a relationship with the centralised Te Whatu Ora. 9 pilot localities were announced in April 2022 with funding from a 2021 budget allocation of nearly $46 million over 4 years to help develop the pilots and test the locality approach. When the Piora legislation came into force in July 2022, it clearly stated a locality would solely be a geographical area, not a community of shared interest, as had previously been speculated. But in his speech announcing the pilots, Health Minister Little described a locality as a, quote, set of relationships between government health agencies, providers, the community, iwi, and the Iwi Māori Partnership Board, end of quote. So, not so clear after all. Language might be the problem here, with localities, locality networks, and locality plans often used interchangeably. The locality pilots, however, pushed confusion to one side, grabbed the baton, and ran with it, preferring to consign details such as, what is a locality, to the let's leave that be box. In taking the opportunity presented by being a locality, the primary care players flung open their COVID playbook and dreamed big. South Auckland's Otara Papatoetoe locality was the largest of the initial pilots. With passion born of its COVID experience, the pilot drew together a multitude of providers, with a dozen full partners and another 50 or so in its network. It took Te Whatu Ora at its word. Network, collaborate, community, integrate, aspire. And it drew up a locality plan to present to National Director Commissioning, Abby Anderson. Bear in mind, these pilots have been pretty much left to define themselves. In the weeks leading up to the great reveal of draft plans, Ms. Anderson said she would be happy enough okaying presentations just showing the direction of travel for the localities. As it turned out, Otara Papatoetoe delivered Ms. Anderson a much more detailed plan. But there was no collective gasp at a remarkable build. Instead, a reminder from Te Whatu Ora it would call the shots, and there was no more funding in the pot. By the time reporter Alan Perrott attended the next locality meeting, a week after the meeting with Anderson, feelings among the locality folk were muted, but not deterred. As it stands now, the only requirements to date of localities are that boundaries be defined by July 2024 and locality plans by July 2025. We have become a very negative, wet, whiny, inward-looking country, and we have lost the plot, and we have got to get our mojo back. That wasn't me. That was National Party leader Christopher Luxon, caught out by a hot mic. Are we whiny and negative? That probably depends on where you are standing. If you're a central or local government politician strapped for cash, I expect you might be feeling a little overwhelmed by the lack of public sympathy for your plight. Numerous voices coming from all directions might sound whiny, negative and plotless to those at the receiving end, but a few strong voices coming together in harmony is hard to beat. Witness the rejection by the General Practice Leaders Forum of the 5% capitation increase. That was not unexpected, but the offer of a 20-point plan towards salvaging general practice services for the community was a welcome development. Sure, some of those points have long been self-evident, but for too long, only to those in the primary care sector. Few national or local politicians have a clue about what happens in primary care, let alone how it needs to change. A strong voice is critical, as is an engaging plot. There should be no fear of hidden microphones. The discussion should be robust as the primary care voice builds its mojo. When it came to COVID, we completely blew out what the value of a life was. Completely. I've never seen such a high value on life. That's a quote from ACT Health spokesperson Boek van Velden speaking during a political panel discussion at the recent Health Tech Week. That quote from Brooke Van Velden, now an Associate Minister of Health and, somewhat ironically, Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, shocks me to this day. The question asked was along the lines of, how do we value life? The value placed on life by ACC, Whaka Kotahi and other organisations was under discussion when the comment was made. Ms Van Velden noted valuing life was quite a technical process and she would not want to put a value on the lives present. Nevertheless, she held a strong opinion on the value of the lives of those who found themselves infected with COVID, and presumably also their families, caregivers, and health workers who were at risk. Ms Van Velden is not alone in thinking the government overinvested in containing the worst, as far as we know it, of the epidemic, but it is far too easy to forget the many unknowns of those early days. Our television cameras show torrid scenes in Italian hospitals, of COVID proving deadly to patients and health workers, of a desperate shortage of ventilators, of bodies being stored in refrigerated trucks. No one knew whether the virus would become more or less virulent. No one knew there would be such a thing as long COVID. Steps were taken on the information available. As a country, we were pretty much on board with saving as many lives as possible. To suggest now that New Zealand completely overspent on saving lives leads to the question, who was not worth trying to save? Few politicians would be willing to spell out exactly who amongst our populace is not worth saving, yet they were absolutely willing to tie the hands of those looking to save the lives of Māori and Pacific patients. The issue of using ethnicity as a tool to help improve health outcomes for Māori and Pacific patients came under fire following mainstream news coverage of an equity adjuster tool being applied in Auckland to some elective surgery patients. The tool uses an algorithm that weighs a number of factors: ethnicity, time spent on the waiting list, geographical location, and deprivation level, all after the primary factor, clinical need, has been considered. It's worth noting ethnicity is a factor in a number of health initiatives, including screening programs and access to medicines. Opposition leaders Christopher Luxon and David Seymour latched on to this latest initiative as evidence of a system giving preference to people based on race. Which is true. The system as it stands gives preference to Pākehā, providing them with longer life expectancy and better health outcomes across most measures. But sadly, that was not the point Mr. Luxon and Mr. Seymour were making. Mr. Luxon decried the use of ethnicity to assist in prioritising surgery waiting lists, saying decisions about surgery should be made solely on health need. Taking into account clinical need, deprivation and time on a waiting list is enough, he says. Mr. Seymour describes the ethnicity component of the adjuster as racial discrimination and, quote, fundamentally un-Kiwi, end of quote. Personally, I think a chunk of the population dying on average 7 years younger is fundamentally un-Kiwi, but I digress. Prime Minister Chris Hipkins defended the ethnicity criteria in Parliament, saying the evidence for its use is clear and applying the adjuster deals to the disadvantaged Māori, Pacifica, rural people and those from low-income backgrounds experienced on elective surgery waiting lists. But then he sort of backtracked by asking the Health Minister to check that everyone is being treated equally. An aspiration contrary to the whole point of the adjuster, which is that not everyone is treated the same. Patients are treated according to need, and need is ascertained by viewing patients through those different criteria. The adjuster is a new approach to an old problem, but the biggest problem remains communicating to the general public why such tools need to be part of achieving equity in health outcomes, how it is that our health system has failed and continues to fail many of the people it is supposed to help. The government has backed an equity approach to healthcare services. Now is not the time for speed wobbles. The price is too high. The lure of invisibility is woven throughout popular culture. H.G. Wells' Invisible Man succumbed to it when a chemistry experiment went wrong. The hobbit Bilbo Baggins found invisibility when he put on the Ring of Power. The Romulans outwitted the Federation with their invisibility-inducing cloaking device in Star Trek. And Harry Potter outwitted his professors and tormentors with his more literal invisibility cloak. I've been thinking that one of the problems faced by primary care for many years has been invisibility. And it turns out this is nowhere near as exciting or as handy in a tight spot as popular culture would have us believe. At the Conference for General Practice, Health Minister Aisha Verrill heard from Taranaki Specialist GP Thaya Ashman about her experience attending a Te Whatu Ora clinical webinar where general practice was invisible. Minister Verrill acknowledged Te Whatu Ora had inherited the biases against primary care held by its constituent DHBs and assured this would change as new Paiora strategies were implemented. Primary care shook off some of its invisibility with its COVID response, but despite the Minister's reassurance, there remains a sense that public sector health managers would rather see the primary care sector, with its mainly private and NGO providers, get back in its box. You can learn a lot about the relationship problem at play here by considering the development of the complicated paradigm that is online dating. First up, ghosting. This describes a situation where one party suddenly stops communicating and completely vanishes from the relationship. Gaslighting, on the other hand, sees one party manipulating the other so the latter begins to question their own reality to the point where they no longer trust themselves, leaving the gaslighter absolved of any responsibility for problems in the relationship. Put them together and you get a newcomer to this hall of relationship horrors. Ghostlighting, where one party ghosts the other and then denies it. But wait, there's more. Fizzling is another relationship landmine. It's sort of ghosting light, where a potential date puts less and less effort into the conversation rather than ending the relationship. The replies are slower and less frequent and shorter, and eventually the fizzler stops and the fizzly is ghosted. I suspect the relationship between Te Whatu Ora and primary care is subject to the innocently termed breadcrumbing, described by Psychology Today as, quote, the act of sending out flirtatious but non-committal social signals, i.e. breadcrumbs, in order to lure a romantic partner in without expending much effort, end of quote. Te Whatu Ora's breadcrumbs include the promise of localities and talk of a roadmap. Throughout the year, work proceeded on the New Zealand Health Charter, Te Mori o Rongo. The Charter is a statement of values, principles and behaviours that health entities are expected to demonstrate in New Zealand. The document was mandated by the Paiora legislation, with an understanding that it would cover all providers of health services that were government funded. In more recent times, there has been discussion about whether this does include the funded sector or not. I think it's important that primary care, or the funded sector, is covered by the Charter. It's mostly a statement of good intent, but the Charter brings responsibilities and obligations which could prove useful when negotiating funding arrangements. But if primary care is not covered, then it will continue to be ghosted by government agencies. There is something about the sound a human head makes when it hits concrete that is not easily forgotten. So begins my late September editorial, a reflection on returning to New Zealand after 6 weeks away. The head in question was that of a man in the crowd at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I caught the arc of his fall out of the corner of my eye. At first I thought he was a street performer and some sort of magic was going to stop his fall, but nothing and no one did. He hit the concrete with a crack. Maybe those standing with the man thought it was a performance, that at the last minute his hands would reach out or his knees would buckle and he would save himself. After all, it is a festival. Context is everything. Returning to the office, the news in my absence has not been good for primary care. It includes financial calamity for practices, PSAP denied, localities trucking on with an unclear destination, nurse pay parity fallout, health worker strikes, urgent care hours cut, and then the piece de resistance, the primary care roadmap. It turns out to be another plan for a plan with a destination 10 years down the track. 6 weeks away and Winston Peters is back in the polls. The election campaign is rattling along and health is hot. Promises and pledges flying as if all the funding problems besetting the sector can be solved just by saying the magic words, if we are government. At a political panel discussion, all the health spokespeople talk of the importance of primary care. Later, I watch a Te Whatu Ora video extolling the new health charter and the single system it claims to represent. The imagery is all hospital-based, not even a token street scene to suggest the community. But my mind keeps going back to the next 10 years and that roadmap of opportunities wasting away as the hospital system aka Te Whatu Ora, continues to feed itself off the back of a narrative of broken general practice, while primary care is left to wait again, putting the entire system at threat. Is this how a patient-centred system is built? It feels like a farce, like some sort of parody of how reform might take place. I wonder where in the arc of the fall the primary care system sits, what hands will reach out to catch it. Where is the bunting? Where are the banners? Where are the bumper stickers? All shouting, 20 million consults a year. What will it take to drill into the national psyche the value of general practice to our health system? 20 million consultations would suggest general practice is thriving, but we know that it is not the case. To ask why general practice is failing when so many GPs, nurse practitioners, practice nurses, practice managers, health improvement practitioners, healthcare assistants, and the rest are working so hard almost seems sacrilegious, but it is failing and being failed. It must be gut-wrenching for a GP to sit in front of a patient who desperately needs a referral to secondary care, knowing that referral will never happen and the patient's health will deteriorate. We continue the myth that if you really, really need help, the New Zealand health system can step up. I've seen and heard enough to know this is not always the case anymore, that the gap between what the system perceives to be high need and what the public perceive is no longer easily bridged. Sure, if you have an acute injury, are bleeding profusely from an open wound, and your heart has stopped beating, you will get help. But you might not be so lucky if you have a condition that makes life a constant misery, but is not actually killing you. It is not an ambulance that sits at the bottom of the cliff of our struggling health system. Rather, it is general practice perched on another precarious ledge, where it continues to provide those 20 million consults a year. Think about it, 20 million. It's the tonnage of silt deposited by Cyclone Gabrielle on the floodplains of the Hawke's Bay. It is the combined populations of Paris, New York, and London. It is the estimated number of lives saved globally in the first year of COVID-19 vaccines. It's a figure landed at, conservatively, through a number of sources. In its Te Pai Tata document, Te Whatu Ora confuses the picture a little, at one point stating there are over 20 million primary care encounters each year spanning aged care, midwifery, pharmacy, whānau ora, mental health, district nursing, allied health and primary care delivered by a mix of private, public and NGO entities. In another section in the same document, it states there are up to 20 million visits to general practices and around 1 million visits to hospital emergency departments. So 20 million is a conservative estimate, but it's easy to remember. It's what we, the public, stand to lose if they, the health ministers and Te Whatu Ora, choose to forget. After weeks of electioneering, the stream of campaign media releases has dried up. It's that twilight zone between governments, the awkward moment before a Saturday night party finds its mojo. The dips are out, but you're not quite sure about the music selection. The Nats and ACT are holding their breath, awaiting the tally up of the 500,000 special votes. They stand like youths at a school dance, wanting to be the cool kids and avoiding direct eye contact with the not-so-cool kids trying to join their wall. It has become a tradition in our household to have a political party on election night. Without disrespecting the event's enormity for those hoping to be elected and dedicated to their respective political causes, at our place, you randomly select a rosette as you arrive and become that party's de facto representative as the election results flow in. Google provides your policy cheat sheet to back up any hoots or hollers you might add to the proceedings. I drew Democracy NZ, a party with which I was unfamiliar. My first thought was that Democracy NZ might have evolved from the Democratic Party, with which I am familiar. The Democratic Party was the funky rebranding of the Social Credit Party. Back in pre-MMP days in 1981, Social Credit achieved nearly 21% of the vote, but the cool kids pilloried it for its funny money policy, and for some reason, I don't quite recall why, for driving Skodas. My dad stood for Social Credit, and I remember hitting the streets of Rangiora as a youngster with a bullhorn on the top of our car. I was surprised to discover the results of these campaigns on Wikipedia. Dad got 3.9% of the vote in the 1972 election in which Labour's Kerry Burke took the seat, and 3% in 1975 when Nationals' Derek Quigley romped in. not too shabby. And I know for sure he was driving a green Holden station wagon. But no, Democracy NZ is not the Democratic Party reborn. Instead, it seems my chosen rosette has led me to a conspiracy theory lodestone, climate change denial and anti-vax. A few people ask me if the election outcome will benefit primary care in general practice. While National Act and New Zealand First promised funding with the potential to alleviate some of the sector's pain, I am confident there will be significant strings attached. And after witnessing several health reforms, I've pretty much concluded that politicians are irrelevant. The real power lies with those at the central health agencies. For now, that is Te Whatu Ora. As the largest agency, it drives the sector's culture. It can choose to enable a one-system culture, as former Health Minister Andrew Little called for, or it can continue to run an us-and-them system, us being those working in public facilities and them being those working in the private sector, as much of primary care does. If Shane Retty holds on to the health portfolio as he shifts from opposition to government, this is the real battle he faces. If general practice were a bird, it would have its own campaign with an endearing but urgent voiceover by Sir David Attenborough. The bird that stays with you and your family through the good times and the bad. One that will go into battle for you with bureaucracies and will run down the corridor to a cardiac arrest in the waiting room or out the door to a prime call out. A fan base would promote it as bird of the century, and a thriving line of household linens would bear the insignia, stethoscope, keyboard, and sensible shoes. There I go again, a cheerleader for the value of good general practice. I attended the Wonka Conference in Sydney with colleague Fiona Cassie. That's the World Organisation of Family Doctors Conference. Around 4,000 GPs/family physicians/primary care physicians from around the globe attended. It was an eye-opener. If global primary care were an action movie, Jason Statham would be tasked with an extraction, getting GPs and their ilk out of hospitals. With his cadre of specially trained black-bedecked operatives, Statham would enter by stealth, my guess is through the ambulance bay. It's a popular option. Finding the GPs, aka family doctors or primary care physicians, won't be easy because their captors will have dressed them in white coats. In other words, they will look like and often mimic the actions of the hospital doctors. And some may not even know they want to be rescued. There's some safety to be had in those white and chrome corridors where the patients don't remember your name. But in this movie, Statham will extract the GPs and deliver them into the arms of their community, where they belong, where they will be welcomed and cherished for the exotic, endangered creatures they are. It was a surprise to discover that general practice as we know it in New Zealand is a relatively rare phenomena. As Fiona reported, generalists in countries like Kenya, the Philippines and Azerbaijan are a relatively new and feisty breed, often finding themselves confined inside hospital walls, with a health system hierarchy staunchly oblivious to the well-documented benefits of doctors working in the community and having long-term relationships with patients. Instead, in some countries, family physicians watch on as the patients and their respective body parts are shuttled from one specialty to the next, with no one quite pulling the whole together. On a global stage, having a specialist GP working in a community setting is confined to a small number of countries, the likes of the UK, Canada, Australia, and Western European countries. Having a specialist GP working in a community setting with the support of a multidisciplinary primary care team, as happens in New Zealand, is an even rarer phenomenon, and, as we are aware, an endangered one. While many other countries are desperately trying to grow a family doctor specialty, others with the general practice workforce at a similar age and stage to New Zealand are confronting existential threats to the specialty's future, at the heart of which is the lack of a genuine appreciation of what it provides and what patients stand to lose as its numbers decline. Health Minister in waiting Shane Retty, himself a specialist GP, understands that good healthcare starts in the community. In the winter of 2003, he spent most of his weekends travelling through Northland, visiting a random selection of houses, knocking on doors and interviewing almost 300 people to understand their health status. He got lost. He crossed swollen streams. He was propositioned by a woman in a bathroom. He was bitten by a dog. He met outlaws and questioned a gang leader in a smoke-filled gang house, all in the name of improving healthcare. All those challenges are outstripped by what comes next for Dr. Retty, not only convincing his fellow cabinet ministers of the necessity of a robust primary care workforce, but also remembering the people behind those doors. When you write about health sector policy, politics and its people for too many years to mention, you start to get a feel for stuff that works. You become invested in outcomes, not only because you're a taxpayer and a potential patient, but because when you are watching people work their butts off, you want it to add up to something. It's an understatement to say that the team at New Zealand Doctor were mildly surprised by the coalition government's proposal to repeal the smoke-free legislation amendments. It's like Health Minister Shane Retty has been strong-armed into one of those old cigarette ads featuring happy white-coated smoking doctors and a slick message on the health benefits of inhaling tar, nicotine, benzene, carbon monoxide, ammonia, dimethyl triazolamine, and formaldehyde, to name a few. And like those ads, ultimately it is about money. The tax taken from cigarette sales today trumps the long-term sad and painful healthcare costs. The moment the news broke, I could see those tobacco company lobbyists high-fiving. Our work here is done. Then packing their bags and heading across the Tasman to sort out the Aussie government's antagonism towards vaping. As one erudite colleague put it, you couldn't make this shit up. Instead of gradually raising the age for cigarette purchases, decreasing nicotine content and limiting outlets, measures that would have curbed demand and reduced ram raids, after all, who wants ciggies without a hit, the coalition government is taking a new approach. It is fostering the next generation of smokers, predominantly Māori Pacific kids according to demographics, hanging on to the levels of nicotine to ensure they get hooked and keeping the numerous outlets because access to death should be convenient. There's plenty more for the health sector to process in the 100-day plan, including Tiakawhai Order's disestablishment, the return of over-the-counter pseudoephedrine meds, the repeal of the Therapeutic Products Act 2023, new health targets, a third medical school in Waikato, and much more. Oh, and did I mention the new baddie in town is the World Health Organization? Beyond the 100 days, each coalition agreement contains further health policy items, including a review of the Māori and Pacific admissions schemes for both medical schools, more money and scrutiny for pharmac, and a call from ACT and New Zealand First to broaden the terms of the current COVID inquiry. That might help shed light on ACT Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden's comment mentioned earlier. Quote, when it came to COVID, we completely blew out what the value of a life was. Completely. I've never seen such a high value on life. End of quote. What value does ACT or all three coalition government partners place on a life? The starting point appears to be the tax on a pack of ciggies. In the final issue of New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa, for 2023, I summed up the year as messy. Messy in the way of an ice cream on a summer day. You're hoping for a relaxing moment in the shade. Instead, by the first lick, you already have sticky streams running through your fingers, and your slow, satisfying foray becomes a sprint to catch the ice cream before it gets away from you, and you can't beat the melt. At its worst, the entire scoop plops off onto the ground. By the end of 2023, Christopher Luxon is Prime Minister. Shane Retty is Health Minister. Among his sidekicks are New Zealand First MP Casey Costello, managing the smoke-free law changes, and ACT leader David Seymour, in charge of Pharmac. Karen Putazi, a former Director General of Health, is now Chair of Te Whatu Ora. For primary care, the future of localities remains unclear. Nurse pay parity remains unresolved. The implications of dissolving Te Akawhai Ora, uncharted. And funding reform for primary care, untouched. So there you have it, sum of 2023. Workforce funding, pay parity, localities, a three-way coalition, and still, always in the background, COVID. Never clear cut, always a bit messy. If you made it all the way through, I salute you. I'll be back with news, interviews and panel discussions looking at developments in the health reforms over coming months. Remember, if you're a health reform junkie or maybe just a little vicariously interested, you can subscribe to System Fix on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Google Podcasts. As I said at the beginning, this episode is not intended as a comprehensive review of 2023. If that is what you are after, take out a subscription to New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. every fortnight in print and weekday online. You'll find news archives going back to 1996, providing extensive coverage of primary care and the wider health sector. Thanks for listening. Ka kite anō. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to keep up to date with issues in primary care and the wider health sector, subscribe to New Zealand Doctor Rāte Aotearoa at nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications offer group subscriptions and discounted subscriptions for health professionals. And don't forget to subscribe to System Fix wherever you usually download your podcasts. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara Fountain signing off until next time. Thanks for listening. Ngā mihi nui. Kia ora and welcome to System Fix in 2024.